35. We are at the last speech of the last portion of the speech of Elihu, who is encouraging Job in kind of a unique way. Job has been pretty much tweaked by these other counselors and friends of his who have just accused him. Because you're suffering so much, Job, you're a sinner. You've blown it. God's punishing you. He's found out your secret sin. He knew what you did in secret. No, we don't know, but he knows, and you must have done something bad. And that's the whole counsel that he got for some 30 chapters of these guys. And Job was forced into a corner, though. He was forced into justifying himself, which was foolish. And Elihu, a guy who's just been hanging out, a young man who's afraid to speak because they were older and wiser, he finally comes on the scene and really gives some good counsel because it's by revelation knowledge. The Lord is speaking to him, and God is giving him a new understanding of what's happening. However, he still does not see the whole picture, but he does set up Job to get ready to hear from God. Now, those are the kind of friends you want. Those who are going to point you to Jesus, point you to God, and at least position you or get you in that place where you're going to listen to what God has to say. Those are the kind of friends you want. And Elihu is that type of friend with Job. In chapter 35, it says, "Moreover, Elihu answered and said, 'Do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? For you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned?'" Now, he's basically picking up on what Job has already said. He's saying, what profit is there for being good? I've been good. I've done all the right things. I'm still suffering. And it was a legitimate question from Job's perspective. But the answer, Elihu says, "I'll answer you and your companions with you. Look to the heavens and see and behold the clouds. They're higher than you. If you sin, what do you accomplish against him? Or if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him?" Proverbs 8:36 say, "He who sins wrongs his own soul." Your sin does not affect God in that sense. You can't affect him. God is beyond our affecting him. He has chosen purposely to be vulnerable to us through his Son. His Son paid the penalty for our price. Yet God is above that. In reality, we've got to see that our sin does not accomplish anything against him or for him, nor does our righteousness accomplish anything. But God is beyond all that. And this is what Elihu was saying. "Job, you're too caught up on yourself. You're too thinking about, you know, you're good and you're bad and that being the effect or the cause or the reason. And that's not it. And I want your companions to especially hear this," he says. He says, "If you're righteous, what do you give him or what does he receive from your hand?" You know, I think about this and I think about how many Christians get caught up in legalism. And they start beginning to think, you know, now I want to read my Bible for God. God, aren't you noticing? Look how many chapters I read. I mean, I've been really good. I've been on the schedule and I've been right on through. And I was 1 week behind, but now I'm caught up. God, you noticed this, right? I mean, I have been doing pretty good. So, you know, you got to bless me here. We don't say it perhaps, but deep down perhaps we think that we read for God. No, we don't read for God. We do not read this Bible for God's sake. We read it for our sake. We need this. This is his word. This is what he wants to speak to us, and we need this. Same thing with prayer. Prayer is not a duty that God is going to look down and go, "Aha, oh, look, they're praying. I'm going to bless them." No, we need prayer. We need to position ourselves in that place of just, "Lord, what are you trying to say to me? Help me. Teach me. I acknowledge I need you to speak to me." And basically, it's for us. It's posturing our heart in the right place. So in a way, what does our righteousness give him? What does he receive from our hand? Nothing. But notice, he says, "Your wickedness affects a man such as you, and your righteousness, a son of man." Your wickedness and your righteousness will affect you, and it will affect others. You can have a great effect on them, but it's not going to mean anything. Now, he's positioning this in a way that is trying to show Job that God is beyond this petty retribution. Ultimately, God's justice will prevail, but we ought not to try to see too much into this experience. And that was wise. He says, because of the multitude of oppressions, they cry out. They cry out for help because of the arm of the Almighty. Now, he shifts gears because he's talking about the wickedness that affects others, and then they're oppressed. And now they cry out for help. But no one says, where is God, my Maker, who gives songs in the night? Isn't it tragic? You would think that only from the wealthy and the doing quite well, thank you, people. That if everything's going fine, surely they will say, well, where is God? Why do I need Him? I don't need God in my life. I'm doing fine without Him. But it's kind of surprising to see that even the oppressed say, where is God? Or don't say, where is God? They don't even come up with the right question. And all this time, the Lord is looking for some to ask Him, where are you, God, my Maker, who gives songs in the night? What a God of comfort we have in the nighttime, in a dreary evening hour when we've been suffering for so long, yet He gives songs in the night. And sometimes some of the most sweet, the sweetest songs, the most beautiful songs come out of the depths of difficulties. Look at the Psalms of David when he cries out to God. I thank the Lord that David was kind of a depressed guy sometimes. Because in his depression, he really just hit the throne room and just cried on his knees for wisdom and direction. God, speak to me. And the Lord spoke to him. And we glean off of that. He says, God who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of the heaven. We pointed out this morning how this whole passage, this whole question, which is so rarely asked. In fact, it's a picture of natural man who does not seek God. It's only by the grace of God that you're even interested in Him. That we even want Him, that we even desire Him. It's because of His grace. But God has done all these things. Therefore they cry out, but He does not answer, and because of the pride of evil man. And he outlines here one of the main causes with that separation between God. Why God will not answer. Oftentimes it comes down to pride. Surely God will not listen to empty talk. You know, He's not going to be impressed with your many words or your prayers. He's not impressed with how you make it sound. Sometimes in public prayers, we're tempted to do that. You know, we want to make it sound good so that people go, ooh, what a cool prayer. And the Lord is just listening to our heart. So pride can definitely hinder that. He says, surely God will not listen, or the Almighty will regard it. Although you say you do not see Him, yet justice is before Him, and you must wait for Him. Hey, Job, it's true. You don't see what's going on, but you have to wait. You know, God is not reaching or reacting now to your situation, but wait. And I believe there's an intimation here that He is not reacting to any of the sin that you did as a result of the suffering. In other words, He's answering both Job and his friends in this one statement. You must wait for Him. Good counsel. Waiting on God. And now because He has not punished in His anger, nor taken much notice of folly. In other words, God hasn't punished you in His anger, and He hasn't noticed any of your folly. He says, therefore Job opens his mouth in vain. He multiplies words without knowledge. In other words, all you're justifying yourself, Job, really doesn't help. It's not going to matter. And later Job does confess and repent before God for trying to justify himself. Now Elihu also proceeded and said, bear with me a little and I'll show you there are yet words to speak on God's behalf. That's how Elihu felt himself. He was speaking on God's behalf. He felt he was receiving from the Lord. He wasn't dependent upon his experience as Zophar and Eliphaz. You know, the human traditions. He wasn't dependent upon that. Bildad with his, legalism. But what he was doing was he was speaking on God's behalf. He says, I'll fetch my knowledge from afar. Which is to say, I don't have it. I have to get it from the Lord. I don't know what to do. And, you know, I think it's a good posture to be in when anytime we want to minister to anyone, if we're going to counsel anyone, when I think of that, I think the awesome responsibility of giving people advice. Giving them advice in their situation. The greatest problem with that is that we don't know everything about them. There are too many people quick to give pat answers and, hey, this is what you got to do. And, well, I tried this. And before they even hear the whole situation, they perceive it's just like them and they're going to throw out some advice. And you know what, folks? I think what we really need to do when we're going to speak with people, encouragement or comfort or any advice, is to sit at the Lord's feet and realize, Lord, teach me. I don't know. Oftentimes when I'm speaking with people in a situation they're describing, they're looking for prayer, they're looking for wisdom, I'm standing there, Lord, I don't have the foggiest idea, Lord, what to tell these people. Help. And it's so amazing how that knowledge from afar, the revelation knowledge, can hit that mark. And the Lord wants to give those words of wisdom, words of knowledge, and prophetic utterances when needed. He wants to speak through us. He wants to empower us. But if we're too quick with the trigger, and we're really quick on our own answer, oftentimes the Lord kind of backs off. He's not going to interfere with our genius. So He waits for us to come to the end of ourselves. He says, I'll fetch my knowledge from afar. I'll ascribe righteousness to my Maker. For truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you. Now, we have to stop there for a second, because we look at this and go, whoa, 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 whoa. Elihu, you're a wise guy and the Lord's speaking to you, but how can you say this? Now, there's a couple of things I would see. Perhaps Elihu is just saying, because of this revelation knowledge, hey, it's going to come out exactly how the Lord wants it. It's perfect. Or he could be expressing that since my knowledge is from afar, I acknowledge it's from my Maker. I ascribe it righteousness to my Maker. It's him he's referring to. He says, one who is perfect in knowledge is with you, that God is with you. He is speaking. I tend to think Elihu is speaking for himself here, but he's not ascribing so much as we would argue with him or say, well, how could you call yourself perfect? But he's thinking about this revelation knowledge. In that moment of inspiration, he really feels God is speaking through him. And now he goes on to express what he feels the Lord is saying. He says, behold, God is mighty, but despises no one. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not preserve the life of the wicked. He gives justice to the oppressed. He does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but they are on the throne with kings, for he has seated them forever, and they are exalted. And if they are bound in fetters, held in the cords of affliction, then he tells them their work and their transgressions, that they have acted defiantly. He also opens their ear to instruction and commands that they turn from iniquity. I like this. Such a different answer from Job's friends, who just said, Job, you're a secret sinner, you're getting your just due, and you've got to eat it. Here he is saying, if there are times when the good men and the righteous people are suffering or struggling, it may be the Lord is disciplining them, they've acted defiantly, there's something, or, he just might be opening their ear, putting them in a position to be open to what God is saying. I know for myself, there are many times the Lord allows suffering in my life to just open my ear. I'm busy here and there, running back and forth, doing all this, a busy, busy pastor, which is an oxymoron, really. Should be sitting at the Lord's feet. And look at Jesus. He never seemed to be busy, but he was always active. And yet he was never too busy for people. And yet the Lord sometimes needs to just slow us down and open our ear into his instruction. It's not that we've committed any grievous sin that he's punishing us for. So often people tend to sway toward Job's friends' advice that they're in some sort of deep sin and they're trying to figure out, what did I do, God? No, it's good always to ask, Lord, is there something I'm not pleasing you? In the final analysis, it might just be that he wants you to sit quietly for a while and listen. He says, if they obey him and serve him, they'll spend their days in prosperity and their years in pleasures. But if they don't obey, they shall perish by the sword and they shall die without knowledge. Again, the ultimate end is in view here. But the hypocrites in heart store up wrath. They do not cry for help when he binds them. In other words, their heart is not really, they perhaps are crying because of the pain and they want it to be removed, but they're not really looking to him. It's all pretend. They die in youth and their life ends among the perverted persons. He delivers the poor in their affliction and opens their ears in oppression. Again, this new idea that the Lord uses suffering to open the ears through the oppression they're experiencing or whatever the circumstance. And I feel if we just listen to the Lord so often when we're going through difficulties. Lord, what do you want me to hear? Is there anything that you're speaking to me? Someone had mentioned, he wondered how these guys who did not have the Bible with them, how they could have understanding, and how did they know what was right and what was wrong? How did they know or discern God's will? How could they even perceive it? I mean, we have the Bible and we have a hard enough time discerning His will sometimes. But you know, one thing they have that we don't have is a whole lot of quiet time under the stars, just listening. No TVs, no radios, no many of the distractions, you know, that we can get distracted by, as Terry mentions, and just that time under the stars, listening very closely, dialoguing with God. Boy, that is something that we need to cultivate more. You know, turn off the TV. Turn off the radio. You know, you have to have that constant, incessant noise in your ears. Maybe the Lord's trying to speak, and He can't get through. So He speaks a little louder through trials. Sometimes He shouts, as C.S. Lewis points out, in pain. Using pain in our life so that He can open our ears to Him. Indeed, He would have brought you out of dire distress into a broad place where there is no restraint, and what is set on your table would be full of richness. But you're filled with a judgment, do the wicked. Judgment and justice take hold of you. Because there is wrath, beware lest He take you away with one blow, for a large ransom would not help you avoid it. Now, it seems like he's accusing Job of the same thing his friends did, but I believe that the context of this is in the light of that one issue with Job. Job was justifying himself, and Elihu felt that Job was going to have to answer for that. He says, will your riches or all the mighty forces keep you from distress? Do not desire the night when people are cut off in their place. Take heed, do not turn to iniquity, for you have chosen this rather than affliction. Because God is exalted by His power, who teaches like Him? Who has assigned Him from His way, or Him His way, or who has said, you have done wrong? The idea here is that God is way beyond any of this stuff. Remember to magnify His work, He says, of which men have sung. Everyone has seen it. Man looks on it from afar. Behold, God is great. We do not know Him, nor can the number of His years be discovered. He says, for He draws up water, which distills rain from the midst, which the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man. Now, there was a storm, obviously, that is beginning to approach, and perhaps the droplets have already started to fall on them. And by the time he's finished with his speech at the end of chapter 37, it's a full-on storm, and all of Job's friends scurry, and Job is left alone there in the courtyard, and the Lord then speaks to Job. Interesting, however, and just a note to keep in mind, at people who level criticism against God's Word, this is a very, very insightful picture of the hydraulic cycle, which was not discovered, or at least put into this type of an understanding, until some 300 years ago. And you hear this book, which is the oldest book in the Bible, it's believed, it goes back even before the books of Moses, that this book records this statement from this guy who is describing this hydraulic cycle. How would they have known that? That it's distilled because water vapor is invisible. How would he know that it draws up, you know, he draws up drops of water which distill his rain from the midst? So you see the cycle. In fact, I believe it was Solomon in Ecclesiastes who poses the question, why do the rivers run into the ocean, yet the oceans are not filled? Which is a very obvious thing. You see these tonnage of water going into the ocean every year after year after year, but the oceans aren't filled. Why? Well, because of, obviously, condensation. The waters, the vapor goes up, forms the clouds, and then comes back and waters the earth, and it's a continuous cycle. And this cycle is expressed here thousands of years before our modern scientists could put it into words. Indeed, can anyone understand the spreading of clouds, the thunder from his canopy? Now, even with our modern meteorological, you know, equipment and understanding, we can tell after the fact when things are formed, yeah, watch out, there's a storm coming here and there, and there's one forming here. But to see all the conditions, that they're still wrestling with a lot of this stuff. It's very, very mysterious. He says, look, he scatters his light upon it and covers the depths of the sea. For by these he judges the peoples. He gives food in abundance. He covers his hands with lightning and commands it to strike. His thunder declares it, and cattle also concerning the rising storm. So in the weather, Elihu is just saying one thing here, that God is beyond us. We don't even understand these simple things. And it's true, you know, there are many, many things in our world that we have not yet discovered, even with all of our modern technology. There are many, many plants that we have not yet discovered. There are many different types of insects. And even the insects that we know and the plants that we know today, there's so many facets of them that can be studied and studied. And you could make a lifetime study out of one plant and still not come to its mysteries. Like George Washington Carver did with the peanut plant. How many amazing discoveries. He made a lifetime study out of the peanut plant. He wanted to study all the mysteries of God. And the Lord says, well, the peanut should keep you busy for a lifetime. And yet look at the mysteries that he uncovered. You know, we walk through our life overlooking so many mysteries. We're so busy going here and there, we fail to see sometimes what's right in front of us. And we fail to see the majesty of God. When's the last time you just went out in your backyard and looked up at the stars and just thought for a moment how vast, how powerful, how awesome God is? Why, one of the least of stars out there are so much greater than our own sun. My favorite star, I think it's pronounced Betelgeuse. It's kind of a strange pronunciation for the type of word it is, but it's a star that's so large, it's 200 million light years in diameter. You could take our sun, with our Earth revolving around it, put it inside this star, and still have 100 million miles left to spare. That's how vast this star is in the constellation Orion. It's incredible. And I look up there and I just think, amazing. And yet there are stars greater than that, which presumably are, you know, turning into black holes because the gravitational force is so heavy that even light can't escape. Fascinating stuff, and yet we have not even uncovered the least of the mysteries. There's so much. And knowledge keeps increasing. So at this also my heart trembles, he says, and leaps from its place. Hear attentively the thunder of his voice. Now he's speaking of the storm and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. He sends it forth under the whole heaven, his lightning to the ends of the earth. And after it, a voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain them when his voice is heard. God thunders marvelously with his voice. He does great things with which we cannot comprehend. For he says to the snow, fall on the earth, likewise to the gentle rain and the heavy rain of his strength. He seals the hand of every man that all men may know his work. Boy, the choices that you make, though they do not affect God, they greatly will affect your destination. They will affect your destiny. Much in the same way when Jesus stood before Pilate, it was not Jesus on trial, it was Pilate on trial. Jesus was laying his life down as a ransom. But Pilate, what will you do with this man called the Christ? And that decision that Pilate made greatly affected him and will affect his destination. The beasts go into the dens and remain in their lairs. And from the chamber of the south comes the whirlwind, the cold from the scattering winds of the north. By the breath of God, ice is given and the broad waters are frozen. And with moisture he saturates the thick clouds. He scatters his bright clouds. And they swirl about, being turned by his guidance, that they may do whatever he commands them on the face of the whole earth. He causes it to come, whether for correction or for his land or for mercy. Listen to this. So in other words, God uses the weather to deal with his people, to either bless them or discipline them, much in the same way the nation Israel, certainly. Listen to this, old Job. Stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know when God dispatches them and causes the light of his cloud to shine? Do you know how the clouds are balanced? Those wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? Now that's a very, very interesting question. If you know anything about water vapor and this whole picture, water vapor is lighter than air. So naturally when water turns into a vapor, it goes up. Goes up into the clouds, it condenses up into the clouds. But once it turns into the cloud, you're already starting to see the condensation. It's become droplets. Why don't those droplets fall right away? They're heavier than the air. It's a fascinating study. I mean, how clouds can contain so much weight and yet still remain there. Well, there are various updrafts that keep it up. There are various currents. There are so many little insights into this. I wish I had time to really study it myself because it's fascinating. But he just throws it out. Do you know how the clouds are balanced? Do you know? Yet we seem to know so many things about other things. And yet here we don't know how the clouds are balanced. These wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge. Why are your garments hot when he quiets the earth by the south wind? With him have you spread out the skies, strong as a cast metal mirror? Teach us what we should say to him, for we can prepare nothing because of the darkness. Should he be told that I wish to speak? If a man were to speak, surely he would be swallowed up. Even now men cannot look in the light when it is bright in the skies and when the wind has passed and cleared them. You know, we can't even look at the sun when it's bright in the sky. Hurts our eyes. How much more would it be difficult to stand in the blazing glory of the Lord? He comes from the north as golden splendor, with God as awesome majesty. As for the Almighty, if we cannot find him, he is excellent in power and judgment and abundant justice. He does not oppress. Therefore, men fear him. He shows no partiality to any who are wise of heart. So whether you're wise or whether you're a fool, God is not going to take that into account because he has a plan. He's omnipotent. He's all powerful. He's omniscient. He's all knowing. He's omnipresent. And he's in all places. God is so far above us. Now, this is the beginning of a foundation of understanding God that we all need to have. Now, Elihu is basically pointing Job to God, and God is now going to answer Job, which we will look at the next time we gather together in this passage. But I can't help but think how important it is for us to see that, yes, God is awesome in majesty and power and way beyond us, and yet God has chosen to reveal himself through his son Jesus. The all-knowing, all-wise, omnipotent Father, in his mercies and compassion and grace, where in the creation the message is clear, you know, who are you to talk back to God? And yet because of God's great mercy, he reveals his mercy and grace in the Son. The law came by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. As God sent his only Son, the express image of the Father, to reveal what he's like in character. Elihu can at best express God's power, which is important for Job to see. And Job will be hit with the same type of questions as God asks him. In fact, once we start seeing God speak, we have a whole lot more scientific mysteries to uncover than we ever had, because obviously God made the universe and he knows every little detail in his formation of it, and even presents in these passages things that scientists today don't have a clue what God is referring to. And yet that's just one side of God, his power. There is the other side, his great compassion and mercy. Yes, when we're going through trials, we can certainly go to his throne of grace. We can approach him. He has made himself approachable through the Son. And as we read Job, we appreciate that much more, because God seems so austere, so separate, so powerful and awesome. And he doesn't even answer Job what he's doing or why he's doing it. He just says to Job, look, who are you? And yet the revelation we have of God goes so much greater through the Son. We are privileged. How can we neglect so great a salvation as this? If there are any here that have not yet made their peace with God through the Son, I'll tell you, what are you waiting for? God is merciful and gracious and compassionate. He is willing to show himself. He is waiting to show his mercy. But the sad, tragic fact is so many people around us still do not ask, where is God, my Maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches me more than the beasts of the field, and makes me understand more than the birds of the heavens? I pray that if you haven't asked that question in your life, you do it tonight. Because God is so willing and eager to answer you and to reveal to you not just his omniscience and omnipotence, but his mercy, his love, his forgiveness, and so much more.